Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about another terrific podcast called Historically Thinking. It's hosted by Al Zambone, a historian, and every week Al talks to historians about how they do their work and about their books and about history in general. This is a wonderful podcast, and it's one of our favorites at the New Books Network, and I really encourage you to subscribe to Historically Thinking. You can go to historicallythinking.org and learn all about it. It's on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe there, and we'd like to give you a little taste of Historically Thinking, so we're going to republish some of Al's terrific episodes, such as the one that follows. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello. In 1866, a 16-year-old cowboy, the name is literal in his case, named J.M. Dougherty, bought 1,000 cattle, hired 5 cowboys, and headed north for Missouri. In Indian territory, he took the long way around Cherokee land to avoid paying them for crossing their grassland. In Dougherty's story, some Yankee Jayhawkers ambushed him, shot some of his companions, and took him prisoner, accusing him of bringing infected cattle into Kansas. Escaping, the teenager found his cowboys, rounded up the cattle, and then brought them finally to market. Some of that story was true, and probably the truest parts were the strangest parts. Cowboys were often incredibly young. Small numbers of them were able to drive immense numbers of cattle for incredible distances, and in the wake of the Civil War, there was always bad blood between the Yankees in Kansas and former Confederates in Texas. With me to discuss the great cattle drives from Texas is Tim Lehman, author of Up the Trail, How Texas Cowboys Herded Longhorns and Became an American Icon, published by Johns Hopkins University Press as part of their series How Things Worked. This is, I think, the second or the third title we've done in that series, and it won't be the last. It's great. Tim, thanks for joining us on Historically Thinking.
Thank you for having me. A pleasure to be here.
So, this is kind of, I told a friend, another Western historian, that I was having a conversation with you, and he said, dang it, why didn't I think of that? It was like lying in plain sight. And I looked through your bibliography and realized that a lot of the books that people are used to referring to when it comes to cattle drives are getting kind of old now. So this was kind of a bright, shiny quarter just lying, or even 50-cent piece, just lying on the sidewalk, I guess.
Right. This is a great story. So many fun things about it. And one of the curious things to me about the so-called New Western history is that they did so much great work on all sorts of interesting new topics, but they kind of forgot about this one. And so there it is. Wonderful story, just begging to be told.
Yeah, and reinterpreted and retold, which you do. One thing which is always interesting to me is the antecedents to this moment. You're speaking about cattle drives from Texas going to Kansas or even points farther north. And yet these were not the first cattle drives in American history or any other history. So we can talk about antecedents. There are Spanish antecedents, right?
Right. So cattle drives started on the Iberian Peninsula and then moved with Spain to the Americas. In the Americas, especially Mexico, cattle were herded often north to markets, sometimes over long distance. They developed techniques. The interesting thing about this is in the Spanish tradition, riding horses was reserved for gentlemen, and cattle herding was a most ungentlemanly, low status job. So what the Mexican vaqueros did was to turn this equestrian turn this into an equestrian profession where they could be on horseback and developed all of the skills, the lassoing, the riding, the cutting out from the herd, and these skills, the branding even, then transferred into Texas. But so many of these were from centuries old cattle drives in Mexico.
And meanwhile, in Britain, there were also cattle drives. People who watched the film Rob Roy or read Walter Scott's book know that stealing cattle, driving cattle, extremely important to the Highlands economy.
Yes.
People even drove cattle all the way from Scotland to London.
Yes.
So they're driving, the purpose of driving cattle is to drive them to market.
Right. That is always the drive from the periphery or the hinterland, somewhere in the rural countryside, to the urban market. And as you say, all the way from Scotland to London. Those drives were done sometimes by professionals, but usually a professional or a career drover would work with a number of young boys. And in that tradition, they also, of course, used dogs, those very smart cattle dogs, border collies, and so on, that we still love. And those dogs, by the way, were smart enough sometimes to find their own way home.
Just like what's the Incredible Journey or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So, I mean, anyone who's owned a Rottweiler soon realizes that they have a herd instinct, and what they're for is herding cattle in the Alps or in Bavaria. That's their job. And they find the alpha cow, and, you know, as we'll discuss, alpha cattle are really important to herds.
Yes.
The other thing that always intrigues me, in colonial America, people don't realize what a big deal and a big economic of what economic importance cattle driving was. People drive up the Shenandoah Valley, your home, where you're born and raised. Drive them up through Winchester to Philadelphia or to Baltimore. They drive cattle through the Carolinas, through the various cow pens to Charleston. I think that's actually Charleston's biggest export in size-wise, not in value, but it's a huge import out of the colonies to be slaughtered in the port cities, salted down, and then sold to slave owners in the Caribbean.
Right. Yeah, so this is the Scots-Irish brought this tradition, and they pursued it, as you say, all over the South East and increasingly Southwest. Asheville, North Carolina, was a big cattle town, but also sheep and pigs, and they might have millions of dollars of commerce in a year.
So all this comes together, this Anglo tradition, and then this new Mexican tradition of non-gentlemen riding horses, roping, branding, all this comes together in Texas. So this is the importance of Texas, is where these two traditions come together, I guess, for the first time?
Right. And, you know, it started early on during the Texan Revolution. They would ride and take cattle, Mexican cattle, and it was part of the war effort, as it were. So they had these so-called cowboy system developed a habit of taking whatever cattle were available, and of course that bothered some people. They thought that cowboys were nothing more than glorified cattle thieves, but they developed that system, and as I say, they learned from the Mexican cattle riders, who were also not above taking whatever cattle were available. And sometimes those cattle would get pushed back and forth across the Rio Grande. I think they must have been the best exercised cattle in history because of how much they moved back and forth across the river there.
So southeastern Texas is full of these are feral cattle by this time, right?
Yes, these are feral cattle, cattle from Spain, Spanish cattle that as they moved north became wilder. They were released from missions and that sort of thing, and their horns grew longer as they needed those longer horns to survive on their own in a fairly wilderness setting. They had to protect themselves from wolves or other predators. They could even use those long horns, some said, to pull down the branches from trees so they could eat the leaves.
So they're browser. These are cattle that can browse. They can survive on anything.
They mesquite, cane thickets, brushland, scrub oak. They could survive just about anywhere.
So what are the estimates of like sort of this feral cattle population in southeastern Texas? I mean, they are in the best, luscious part of Texas is where they're sort of located. But what are they must be tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands, but even more by the end of the Civil War. Estimates are usually at about 5 million.
Really?
And
why at the end of the Civil War?
Well, during the Civil War, the men went away to fight, at least a good portion of them, and the cattle ran wild. And they're also they're very good breeders, those Spanish longhorn cattle. And they mixed with some American cattle to give them a sort of a distinctive genetic makeup. Mm-hmm. They bred with great fecundity.
So I mentioned in the case of J.M. Dougherty, this is 1866. And 1866, post-Civil War, this seems to be an important moment. People like this kid, realize that there's money to be made here. You just have to, quote-unquote, rope free cattle and then get them to market.
Right, exactly. It's getting them to market is the trick, of course, because the cattle are free or nearly free. It takes some labor to round them up and get them together. But the markets were distant, and when the railroads started moving across Kansas, that put dollar signs in people's eyes.
So I guess the whole sort of the historical sort of moment of contingency is that the railroad didn't come into Texas first.
Right. It did not come into Texas. And they had tried things like steamships and drives to New Orleans, in fact. None of those worked particularly well for a variety of reasons. So this seemed to be the next big thing. In that sense, the cattle drives are part of that Gilded Age entrepreneurial spirit. These people are in, part Davy Crockett and part John D. Rockefeller.
Yeah. Why didn't driving it to New Orleans work, or steamships? Why don't steamships work?
Cattle would lose a lot of weight on steamships and sometimes die.
Yeah.
And New Orleans had an awful lot of woods and river crossings to get through.
Sure, of course. So they drive them north. They soon realize there's another benefit to that, which is that grass is better outside of Texas. I guess the whole idea of this is to do this for free. You want to get the free cattle, and then you want to fatten them up on someone else's grass or on common grass.
Right.
That's the whole business model. So
yeah, it's a great business model, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's looking for quarters on the sidewalk again, to continue that metaphor.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you make clear from the very beginning is that there's a great deal of centralization going on. This is connected to centralization and industrialization. How so?
Well, I guess we could start with the railroads. Now, of course, this is the Kansas Pacific, so we're looking at a transcontinental railroad. That railroad has to be talked into buying to building a spur line to a cattle market. Those things don't just happen by chance. In this case, Joseph McCoy was an Illinois cattleman who saw this cattle market in Kansas as an opportunity. He spent several years lobbying people to get the right infrastructure in place. He spent his own money to build stockyards just outside of this town of Abilene, which wasn't really a town until he got there. Mm-hmm. And after convincing the railroad to build the spur line there, then he spent thousands of dollars of his own money in advertising to get Illinois cattle buyers there, as well as probably hundreds of dollars convincing Texans to drive their cattle there. You know, the cattle market didn't just happen. It had to be created by hard work, entrepreneurial activity.
And you say that people are also, there's a sort of a diet craze going on in the East, in which people are trying to eat more beef, which...
Right. I love it. Beef is a health food of the day.
Sure.
And it will make you manly. It will build strength. It had a sort of middle class respectability about it. This is, of course, in contrast to pork, which was losing favor as the food of poor people. And I think it was Good Housekeeping who a dietitian there wrote that pork is not suitable for intelligent people. And so. the beef market was just opening up in that sense.
And it's funny because these things must go in waves. I think the Zoa archaeologists at Williamsburg report that something like 95% of all animal bones that they find in trash pits are either beef or mutton.
Well, yeah.
So I imagine pork had its day maybe after the revolution, and then, you know, back came beef.
Right.
Mutton never came back. So they see their opportunity and they take it. So can you trace what they start? A drive would start in, say, Southeast Texas. I realized reading this book and, of course, looking at the map and thinking about it, that there's a lot of Texas to get through if you're starting down in the Southeast corner. So describe a cattle drive going north.
So they would start in, as you say, even close to the Rio Grande in Southeast Texas. And so the first month or two, several hundred miles might be through settled or developed territories where they would have to avoid towns. The good part was they could buy groceries or any foodstuffs from farmers along the way. The bad part was that they had sometimes conflict with those same farms. Mm-hmm. They could increase the size of their herd. They could pick up, that is, more cattle, either legally or sometimes illegally. Uh-huh. Some farmers complained that Bessie the milk cow ended up in the cattle drive going by, and so there's some of that going on. And then they would get to Fort Worth. Usually, and at Fort Worth was the last opportunity to stock up, to get provisions. And from there, they had then 100 miles or so of North Texas, which was lightly settled. And then they crossed the Red River into Indian Territory. And for some of them, that was the real wilderness. That was where the adventure began.
So how many cattle would be on a drive like this? There's no such thing as an average number. But give some perspective on that.
Right. So 1,000 was pretty normal. In the first years, 1866-67, there's a lot of experimentation, and a lot of small ranchers might try with several hundred herd, even 600-800. But by 1868 or 69, they're doing mostly herds of 1,000 or even 2,000, sometimes 3,000.
Wow.
Were the most common.
How many men does it take to handle a herd of 1,000? Doherty used six, including him. Is that small? Is that normal?
That's small.
Yeah.
2,000, the standard was, or the most common was probably about 12 people. Mm-hmm. So you had a trail boss who would ride out front, set the route they would take that day, find the water holes, find the campgrounds. And he was maybe the most important person in terms of making a successful drive. Behind him would be the lead riders, who would be at the head of the herd with the lead cows. And then behind them, the flank and all the way at the back would be the flank or the swing riders along the herd, which might be stretched out for several miles. And then at the back would be the drags.
Which is the worst job of all, it would seem, reading your book. You never stop coughing up dust, probably for the rest of your life.
Yes, those people got enough dust. They couldn't stop coughing up black phlegm for months, and maybe, as you say, for the rest of their life, because it was in their lungs.
It was interesting to me. There is no sentimentality towards the horse. They obviously, when you make sense, they have to switch horses a lot as they're riding for all day long. You can't ride a horse all day long. You have to keep on switching horses. So horses are just tools, like everything else they've got around them.
They treat them more or less like a piece of machinery. They're riding all day and part of the night,
yeah.
Usually, because they have to do night duty. And so each of those riders probably needed three or four at a minimum, and as many as six or eight different horses.
Wow.
And they tended to ride them pretty hard, despite what we hear about the sentimentality that developed. There were a few cowboys who would bring their own horses. Maybe they had a favorite, mm-hmm. and that would be the horse that they would ride on a special occasion when they expected a harder work, like a river crossing or to gather the herd after a stampede. Mm-hmm. So there is some of that, but... most of that sentimentality towards horses developed later.
So the other people, I think I haven't mentioned them, the cook and the wrangler. The wrangler takes care of the horse herd. I was surprised to realize that that was not a high paying or a high status job. I would have thought that that would be a very invaluable position, but it doesn't seem to have been paid that way.
It certainly wasn't paid that way, and often it seemed like it would be one of the younger members, one of the farm kids who was looking for a little summer adventure.
Hmm. And then the cook.
And the cook, there seems to be a great deal of variation in the status of the cook. The cook might be the second highest paid person on the drive and might be the lowest status. Cooks tended to be sometimes older cowboys who were maybe a little the bones were a little too old to handle that much riding, and so they would go along as a cook. Sometimes it was Mexican-American or African-American. And if they were a good cook, they had a special status. If they were not so good, then their status could be pretty low.
I should say what people were getting paid. The trail boss made like $100 a month, a good one, I guess.
Yeah, they might make as much as 100 a month.
And just to give perspective, I believe I looked this up that a skilled blacksmith in say 1870 would make $350 a year. So 100 a month is for 3 months, 4 months. That's not bad.
Right. So a trail boss is doing all right and might be actually able to put some money away, mm-hmm. As you say. Now, of course, in comparison to the blacksmith, his work is seasonal,
yeah,
and he may go just as long unemployed as employed. The herders, especially as you get the farther back the herd you get, the lower the pay typically, and so they might at drag somebody might be making $20, maybe $30 a month. $30 to $40 is pretty common. They tended to pay Mexican American and African American workers less. In fact, some cattle drovers preferred Mexican riders because they had typically more skill than the mm-hmm. Texans, but you could pay them less.
Huh. So these guys were young. You point out the name cowboy in many cases is there's a reason why they're called that. They're young or they're Mexican or they're African American. That seems to be there as often. Is that right? I mean, is that the demographics of them?
Yeah, that is the demographics. Unfortunately, there's not any really good definitive evidence about the exact makeup of that. Mm-hmm. It's clear that there were lots of African Americans and Mexican Americans. But historians have had a little back and forth over that, trying to sort it out. The most common number you hear is 1/3 were African American. Unfortunately, when you track that down, it comes down to the sort of speculation, a guesswork mm-hmm. by George Saunders, who collected a lot of these trail narratives, much after the fact, though.
What? How do you herd 1,000 cattle or 2,000 cattle when there's like 10 of you? How's that work? Especially when these are semi-wild or wild cattle at first when you pick them up.
Right. The good thing is, once you get them, as they said, trail broke, they would herd themselves. So you might have to work especially hard, but they would typically find a social hierarchy among the cattle. The lead steer, lead cow, or often lead ox would mm-hmm. be absolutely crucial. And then they tend to find, after 3 or 4 days on the trail anyway, they would tend to find the same place. That is, they would have the same – they would keep the same company, the same bovine company every day. And so they tended to fall in place. And so one of the interesting things about longhorns is you can say that in some sense they were their own labor force. They did a lot of the work themselves. The cowboys, of course, moved alongside. They decided how fast or how slow, where they bedded down at night or bedded down at noon, and they had a sort of a pretty slick system of hand signals, so they could go up and down a line that might be 4 or 5 miles long and give signals to each other about slowing down, speeding up. Squeezing them would tend to speed them up, or they could expand them and let the cattle drift a little bit more.
So they have a great attentiveness to the herd nature of the longhorn. They really know how to work with the grain of the wood. Using the lead cow or the lead ox was Old Blue. Was Charles Goodnight sort of?
Yeah,
I love that story.
Yeah, Old Blue was Charles Goodnight's favorite. They said that Old Blue knew the way to Dodge City better than most cowboys because, of course, you had a good lead ox like that, you never would take him to the butcher house. So he'd return back to the ranch and do the same trip again the next year.
So some 2,000 cattle are following this one ox.
Yeah. And this Old Blue became such a favorite that he would wander into the campfire circle at night and look for special treats and that sort of thing.
But the downside or another part of their herd nature is that they stampede really easily because if there's danger, they're going to get away from it as fast as possible. So that seems to me reading through it, that's always the biggest danger that the cowboys were facing on the drive.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The prospect of stampede was ever present because longhorns, being both a herd animal and a semi-wild animal, a prey species, always on the alert, very sensitive to danger. So sometimes if they're near a settlement, something as simple as a woman doing her laundry on the wash line might start a stampede. sometimes, of course, storms, thunderstorms common on the southern plains there could start a stampede. Sometimes stampedes were started deliberately by somebody who might want to pick up a few stray cattle, and sometimes it could be simply the smell of a predator even that could cause a stampede. The rhythm of the trail is just sort of mind-numbingly boring for days or even weeks at a time, punctuated with these moments of sheer terror. Life-threatening stampedes At the best, a stampede meant 2 to 3 days of really hard work.
Before we get, as it were, go across Red River into Indian territory, guns and cowboys. We know what the myth is. What's the reality?
So, again, reading all of these personal documents, guns don't come up very much. Mm-hmm. Although we've forgotten this, Texas actually had gun control. Mm-hmm. There was a Texas law against carrying guns in public. So while they were in southeast Texas, in settled Texas, it would have been illegal to carry a gun publicly. And often on the trail, the trail bosses didn't want their hands to carry guns.
Right.
Because guns had no particular use. They might get away. And if they did actually use them, it would start a stampede.
Right. If they stampede over laundry, they'll certainly stampede over gunshots.
Right. And so a lot of times the cowboys who didn't have guns with them would keep them with their bedroll, which would be stored in the chuck wagon during most of the trip.
Mm-hmm. It's not to say that once they got, as we'll see, once they get to Abilene or eventually Wichita, that they're not buying new guns and fancy ones.
Yes.
It's just there's no particular need for it on the trail drive. And
right.
And to carry one in public in Texas is already to break the law.
Right.
And also, for that matter, most of the cow towns, they had pretty strict gun policies as well.
Yes, they did.
As we'll see in just a second. So they crossed into Indian territory. What Indian territory? What does that mean?
Well, this is the this is the end point of the Trail of Tears for the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw. So these are the so-called civilized tribes who were nations, sovereign nations recognized by the United States government with rights to control their own territories. And many of them were herding peoples because they had learned to herd cattle from their southeastern neighbors in Georgia and Alabama and so on. And unfortunately for them, they had a well-developed herding economy that was devastated by the Civil War. So that meant their grasslands were largely vacant at this point. They asked they passed laws, actually, charging a toll, a fee for herds that would cross their land. Mm-hmm. And they would also ask, both formally and informally, for a few cows. Mm-hmm. Now, Texans met that in different ways. Some of them simply paid it and saw it as an unavoidable cost of doing business. Others saw it as an Indian menace, as a threat, the Indian threat, and so on. They met it with the Winchesters. They met it with the sort of Texas bluff and bravado. And refused to pay.
It's interesting the variety of responses to it. It was kind of extraordinary, actually, to think that there were that many different approaches to it. So, as you say, some people just see it, well, I'm paying for grass and water, which they get in abundance. Other people like Dougherty go all the way around the Cherokee or the Choctaw or someone else to avoid it.
Right. And of course, some of them would slow down their herds while passing through Indian grasslands so as to allow the herds to gain weight.
Yeah, that's one of the things they discover, right? That they realize that the northern grass, even Oklahoma and Kansas grass, is just more nutritious, and cows can fatten up.
Right.
So they get them across Indian territory, and they come into Kansas. And Kansas is kind of it's hard to see whether Kansas benefits or suffers because of the cattle business. What's the problem for Kansans?
Yeah, Kansas both benefits and suffers. So Kansas has at least two kinds of problems. One is that these longhorn cattle carried with them a cattle tick.
Yeah.
That caused Texas fever is the most common name, and the Texas cattle, the longhorns, were immune to this, having spent many generations with this cattle tick endemic. The Kansas cattle, or any northern cattle, would suffer in large numbers and die sometimes as much as 80% of a
wow.
herd. So
what is this Texas fever?
Well, it comes from a cattle tick, a Bufalus tick that carried with it a protozoa.
Okay.
And these came all the way from West Africa,
okay.
Through Mexico, Central America, and north to Texas. And the cattle tick, by the way, spread all over the South, the American South. I should say that in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, the source of the disease that everyone could see, Texas fever, mm-hmm. Was not identified with the cattle tick. That came later, and when people realized it was this tick that caused the disease. And so that's part of the controversy. Then people knew that Texas cattle caused death to Kansas cattle.
Uh-huh.
In the same way, by the way, South Carolina cattle or Virginia cattle, if they were carried north all the way to Pennsylvania or New York, might cause death to cattle there.
So this is another example of the Columbian exchange. This is the old world disease that infects is death on new world cattle.
Right.
Whatever.
Right. Yeah. And this, developed in the tropics and the subtropics that did not work well. It's almost uncanny how much this is was sometimes called Southern fever, sometimes Texan fever. When they did in the 1890s, the veterinarians and scientists drew a line of where this cattle tick lived. It pretty much described the Confederate States.
So that reflects also this. This is not. I guess maybe it's in the movies. I don't know. But I guess I never thought of the Confederate Yankee thing. Obviously, Kansas was in many ways the flashpoint for the Civil War, or at least from in 1855 onwards. And nothing has really changed in many ways. The blood has not changed between the Northerners and Southerners, at least on the cattle drive.
Right. So there's still a lot of sectional animosity and distrust. Partly it focused on this Texas fever. Partly it focused on the fact that these cowboys who would come to town brought with them this herding tradition. And especially by the time they got to into the towns like Abilene or Wichita, they were ready for a spree. They would drink. They were lawless. They liked to shoot the pistols into the air. And these Kansas farmers were good church-going, school-building, community-building sort of people. They wanted to create a society that you might think of as almost New England or certainly Midwestern in its more respectable sort of elements. And these Texas cowboys were just the stuff of nightmares for them.
And at least initially, a lot of those Texas cowboys were Confederate veterans, and a lot of those Kansas farmers had just been shooting at Confederates.
Yes, and they didn't forget that.
No. So, nonetheless, we've got people like Joseph McCoy. You've mentioned him. He's 29 years old. Like most people in the story, Charles Goodnight's 20 when he starts the Goodnight loving trail. Joseph McCoy is just 29, and he gets this idea, this bright idea to create Abilene, to create this cow town. The profits involved are really kind of extraordinary. You have the cost for the a 900-pound steer. It cost you $11 to $14 in Texas. It bumps up to $28 in Abilene. That's what we're looking at. We're looking at a doubling the price of a steer by driving it north to Abilene.
Right.
And then it's $38 on the hoof in Chicago when it gets to Chicago. So that's right. that's the profit motive that gets people up the trail.
Right. The great water great Texas historian Walter Prescott Webb of an earlier generation, several generations earlier, said it was to the goal of the cattle trails was to connect the $4 steer with the $40 market.
Yeah.
And that may have been a little exaggeration, but that tenfold increase is what what people hoped for. Mm-hmm. And as you say, in the numbers, the actual numbers didn't always do that. But a doubling in profit was good money.
Yeah, no kidding. So were these cow towns, Abilene, Dodge City, Newton, Ellsworth, Wichita, spring up like Newton and last for a season. Other ones last for longer. How's this happening? Competition, right?
Right. So they're split. Popular opinion in and around each of these towns is split. On the one hand, they see the cattle business as a source of revenue and the next big thing, which will elevate their town to be the premier town of the region. On the other hand, as we've said, they're a little bit nervous about all these rude and wild cowboys being around.
So it was just, you say a saloon could be built for as little as $400 and earn $100 a night.
Right.
Talk about profit incentive.
Yeah,
that's pretty amazing.
And some of these towns, you could even throw up a saloon in a tent sometimes.
Yeah.
And
it's
Newton in particular.
Yeah, it's the ultimate in incremental development. And, the incentives, prostitution too. A woman earns $1 to $2 a day cleaning, $5 a night as a prostitute.
Right. And so there could be incentives. You know, the scholarship on prostitution is interesting in that it is hard to get hard to get really good, reliable information on, for instance, how many prostitutes are there because of that profit motive. Certainly some of them are. But there also is some evidence of people who were basically carried into prostitution. I suppose in the 21st century, we might call them sex slaves. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly potentially lucrative, but also potentially very dangerous.
Sure.
They had very little protection from the law.
As you point out, that's going to be the greatest focus of violence. If we want to look for violence in a cow town, it's going to be in the sex trade.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. What are these 20-year-olds or 18-year-olds get up there? What do they spend their money on? I guess we shouldn't be surprised that it's liquor and clothes.
Liquor, clothes, and gambling are the ones that everybody is probably aware of. What surprised me most was food, and especially groceries.
Yeah,
they want fresh vegetables.
Yeah,
they want onions and potatoes and greens after months of a diet of sourdough biscuits and beans. With, if they're lucky, a little bacon grease thrown in.
Yeah, they were not eating their profit on the trail, I notice. And they didn't even like buffalo, which is kind of extraordinary to me.
Right.
When they could get it. So they spend, who makes money? Do any of these kids ever, I guess there's one or two geniuses who are squirreling away their, half of their profits to go back and be ranchers, but not many.
Right. There were a few. And I just since the book came out, I came across a story of four African-American cowboys from East Texas who saved their money and went home and bought ranches. And so that using that money as potential for social mobility was possible. But by far the most common thing was to simply spend it. There's a great narrative in the collection of trail narratives that I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. where the guy simply says, "And then I got to Abilene and the alcohol and the gambling tables, and well, you boys know the rest of the story. I went home and had to beg for food all winter long."
Wow. The railroads engage in overbuilding through Kansas. Does that affect the story, or is this where the story ends, with the railroads finally extending themselves so that you don't have to drive on the trail anymore?
Well, the railroads in Kansas certainly overextended, and it shaped the destination, especially the railroad competition, a second railroad through Kansas that was almost certainly not necessary, but created Dodge City, the last and most famous of the cow towns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing about that was the railroads. And I think this is revealing about how those frontier communities work. The railroads had plenty to bring from the east to the west, manufactured goods, foodstuffs, as well as passengers. They had, at least in Kansas, very little return back to the east. And that helped make the drive to Kansas profitable because it kept railroad freight rates low.
Okay.
They were anxious to be able to load those cattle because they had nothing else, or not much else to put on for those return trips to the east.
They didn't want them to be deadheading on the way back. So they've got the price goes from $7 a head to ship cattle to $2 a head, which is extraordinary. How does this all end? You describe the drives get ever more longer. They're driving cattle farther and farther north. Is that for the grass?
Yeah. So the drives almost end after the panic of 1873.
Really? Okay.
That early. The railroads. Railroads after that. Started to come into Texas, so there by the mid 70s there were some railroad alternatives to cattle drives, but Joseph McCoy, for instance, thought, well, the time for cattle drives is over, and he said that and wrote that publicly. And but then what happened is, after the demise of the buffalo and the subjugation of Plains Indians, the Comanche and the Sioux in particular, the northern ranges opened up. And that's where these northern range bunch grasses could fatten up Texas cattle. And so if you could just get those cattle up there and then they'd eat that northern nutritious northern grass for a few years, they could be extraordinarily valuable. And so that's when Wyoming, Montana, Nebraska, the Dakotas filled up with these cattle coming in from Texas and other places.
I never thought about this before, and it's silly that I didn't, but being a cowboy is a Texas thing that eventually is exported north. That Wyoming people are not cowboys until they learn how to be so from Texans.
Exactly. Because there were cattle coming from, say, Illinois into Wyoming and Montana, but you don't learn how to be a cowboy from herding cattle in Illinois.
No.
It's a Texas thing.
Yeah. Okay. It's the combination of the horse, the lasso, the branding. You might be herding them with dogs or something like that in Illinois and in Wyoming at first, but then that changes.
Yeah. What happened? Well, so two things happened to end the drives. One was in Kansas, the fear of Texas fever kept pushing they had a quarantine line that kept moving west, and mm-hmm. and cattle drives east of that line were illegal. And finally, in 84, the Kansas legislature just said the whole state is quarantined to Texas cattle. And so that left very little opportunity. Wyoming also did not like Texas cattle. And so that was one thing that was closing the gate. And the other then is here on the where I am in Montana and Wyoming in the winter of 1886-87, there was the Great Die-Up, mm-hmm. it's called. And bitter, cold winter, 20, 40, 50 below zero combined with deep snows meant that cattle froze in large numbers. Some herds, almost entire herds, people lost almost all of their cattle, 90% in some counties. Estimates are hard to be accurate, but perhaps as many as two-thirds of the cattle in northern Wyoming and Montana died that winter. And so people moved away from longhorns. They moved towards pasturing cattle in fenced pastures with hay fields and a more conventional system.
So the cattle trade continues, but there's no need for the drives anymore.
Right.
And I guess that was 1886 was very bad for Teddy Roosevelt and ranchers in Montana and Wyoming, but it must have been a very good year for Texas ranchers, you would think.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I never thought about it. They enjoyed the price of beef was excellent from their perspective.
Right.
But by that time, they had railroads. They could herd them to Fort Worth and get on the railroad there or something like that.
Right. So they're getting their cattle to market in other ways. And and even what might have been their best strategy from an economic point of view would have been to longhorns typically needed some fattening up on either corn feed or grass or something. And they if they had done that in Mexico and put the slaughterhouses in Texas, mm-hmm. they may have made more profit altogether. All that money that went into Kansas City and Chicago slaughterhouses could have happened closer to home.
Right. So that by this time, then we've got this whole grain finishing in the stockyards of Omaha and Kansas City and Chicago, and then the whole that is that right? I mean, that's the 1880s,
right.
1890s thing.
Right. So that's the 90s pattern.
OK. It's interesting. So that's when Americans get used to the idea of grain finished beef rather than grass finished beef.
Right. I find it interesting that we're going back to, some people prefer the grass beef now, and you pay a premium for that now even. But,
yeah. I prefer it. And it's actually it turns out those health gurus of 1860s were right. I mean, a grass to finish beef is a wonderful, a very healthy thing indeed.
Yes. Yes, it is. And the other thing that's happening, of course, is refrigerated railroad cars, which it changed the way beef slaughtering was done. And, that's a story sort of beyond my book in some ways,
and oddly enough, we just talked with Jonathan Reese about that. Which I think will be the week before when this podcast drops. So people listening to this will just have heard about refrigerated train cars. That was completely by accident. I did not plan on that until I just realized that now. Back to Teddy Roosevelt. I hadn't occurred to me that in many ways the way that the cowboy enters into American mythology as an image is because of Teddy Roosevelt, because of him. Is that part of your argument?
Teddy Roosevelt and a few others as the cattle drives were in fact ending. Mm-hmm. In the 80s, there seemed to be this thirst for cowboy stories. Buffalo Bill Cody and the Wild West show and other Wild West shows told cowboy stories that were enormously popular, dime novels. And of course, then Teddy Roosevelt is most certainly the most famous of all of these people. He came west, ranched, and wrote about it. And the famous quip about him when he became president is now that damned cowboy is in the White House. And of course, he was only a sort of a part-time cowboy. Some people call him a pretend cowboy because it wasn't really an extended career or anything for him. But he did celebrate the romance and the myth of this rugged, independent person who was especially good. It was nostalgic. He was looking at a time, an imagined time in American history when, men were men and adventure was available to all.
Which was only 15 years before.
Yeah.
I mean, that was nostalgia for 15 or 20 years in the past, which I guess that's you can see that happening now too. That's a recurring theme in nostalgia is often for a much more recent time than we think.
Yeah. And for at least partially imagined time as well. Mm-hmm. Teddy Roosevelt didn't romanticize the work of the drag cowboy.
No.
He romanticized the freedom of the open range.
Well, I think he had lost a lot of money in the 1886, the great die out. But
right.
By the time he got to North Dakota, he was really after the era of the great drives. Right. I mean, he was fattening him up on his range and taking him to the local slaughterhouse.
Right. Yeah. He's came after the drives. I think it'd be interesting to think what would happen to him had he gone on a drive. He may have changed his tune a little bit.
But, maybe. But, it's powerful in him. And I guess his idea is that, he comes out an asthmatic and he leaves stronger and healthier than ever in his life. So it's that's a powerful sort of personal success story that's in his
exactly.
mind.
And it's a wonderful story for him, but it's probably the exact opposite of what happened to most people who were actually cattle workers. They ended up with bodies crushed and broken, all stove up, is the old cowboy expression, by 35 maybe.
Yeah.
And perhaps coughing up dust from your lungs for the rest of your life. So
yeah.
What worked for him worked in the opposite way for a lot of the actual laborers.
Yeah, I was wondering when you said that Cook was the old guy, I was wondering, is that like 35, 40? That's probably how old they were.
35 to 40 is definitely a veteran on the trail drives.
As we need to wrap this up, the number of people who are actually involved in the drives is really astonishingly small.
Right.
What's your estimate?
Well, estimates range from 10,000 to 30,000.
Total.
And
Or in a year.
In a year, it would be a fraction of that.
Huh.
I think that almost certainly the 30,000 estimate is high and 10 to 12,000 total and perhaps fewer than 1,000 in any given year. The other thing is most of these herders did not go up the trail more than once.
Yeah. Once was enough.
Yeah. Once got you to be what they called a graduated cowboy, and no reason to do that again.
Yeah, so it's people would just go back and they would work the range in their home area.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, what's your favorite movie about a cattle drive?
Favorite Red River.
Yeah, I was thinking about that when reading your book. Red River is really, except for the ending, Howard Hawks kind of wimped out there.
Yeah, I think – I agree.
The first time I watched it, I could not figure out what the heck was going on in the last, 10 minutes? It happened so fast. But it's a very – it's a great movie for that. Why not Lonesome Dove?
Well, best book.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
I mean, it's a genius of a book. Because when you think about cowboy literature, not very much of it is about cattle drives.
No, you're right. Yeah.
The Virginian, for instance, the traditional or classic cowboy novel from 1902, there's almost no cows in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so Larry McMurtry's a genius to make the cattle drive the central plot device and for 800 pages and make it work.
And Howard Hawks in Red River, though, I think you point this out, and I think this is so – he captures the monomania, the John Wayne character of getting those cattle to market, which must have marked – I mean, Charles Goodnight must have been a hard person to be around sometimes.
I think so.
Yeah. And this kid J.M. Dougherty, there's a great movie there, but if even half of his story is true, he was monomaniacal to the nth degree.
Yeah, yeah. And he went on, had other drives and became a successful rancher.
Not surprising.
Yeah.
All right. What are you working on now?
Right now I'm working on something about wolves in the American West, and the American West, including the Canadian West.
Wolves in the American West. And what is that? How they're hated, how they become either blamed for everything or the best possible animal in the world, or what?
I love them because they have such symbolic power for humans. It's a sort of thing that gets people riled up. And so I'm not out I'm more interested in how wolves have been a part of the fabric of life over a couple of centuries here.
Hmm. My guest today has been Tim Lehman. He is the author of Up the Trail: How Texas Cowboys Herded Longhorns and Became an American Icon. Tim, thanks so much for joining us on Historically Thinking.
Thank you.
For more Historical Thinking, go to our Facebook page, where you can comment on today's program and suggest ideas for programs to come. Please subscribe to us on Apple iTunes. And if you like what you've heard, please, please leave a review so that others can find us. Our program's editor is John Runnett. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.